Live from the studio on Friday morning, for me anyway, Friday afternoon for you. I literally just woke up. This is podcast 547, this week's radio show, Bob Davis podcast radio show number 43, which, because I have been off for the last week or so, is brand new content. I decided to take a time off from last Friday all the way through this week, Labor Day week. So I'm kind of feeling pretty good and pretty rested. So let me just say, this radio show is brand new content, and it's pretty intense content, because what I'm attempting to do is put election 2016 in some kind of context. I'll explain it, but these are not excerpts. This is interesting, because this really, I'm butting right up against the radio format, because this would have lent itself much better to a podcast, but I did it in four segments, and so it's very closely packed and pretty intense, and it's good listening for political people, for weekend listening. So without any further ado, I'm just going to roll segment one, and here it is. Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. For all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. We are roughly 60 days from a general election in the United States. There's going to be a popular vote for the presidency. 435 members of the House of Representatives are going to be chosen, and one-third of the U.S. Senate. In addition, a host of local, county, state, and ballot issues are going to be decided on November 8th, 2016. I personally see this election as one of the worst in U.S. history, let alone in my lifetime. Maybe the American people agree. If you look at polling, you'll see that both mainline political candidates are viewed very negatively by potential voters. The word disillusion means disappointment resulting from the discovery that something is not as good as it was once believed to be, or something causing somebody to realize that a belief or an ideal is false. Disillusion is also defined as the condition of being disenchanted. Maybe you like religious metaphors, and if you do, you might say disillusionment results from the scales falling from your eyes. Your sight is restored because you have a spiritual awakening of some kind. You become enlightened. I would say I'm disillusioned but not yet enlightened by what I see in the political process in the United States in 2016. And I think it's been a long time coming. In recent podcasts and radio shows, I've asked listeners to think about how they define themselves as human beings and about what is next in the world and in our politics. 2016 might be remembered as the last election in which the left-right Republican-Democrat orientation was present. It's obvious that the American political spectrum is realigning, shifting into something completely new. This is why you'll often hear people say things like, something's going on. That's what they mean, I think. You feel it if you are someone who has defined themselves as a conservative for the past 40 years, since the emergence of a new coalition of Republican voters and politicians at the end of the 1970s and on into the 1980 election, especially if the icons and institutions of that era, like Ronald Reagan and talk radio, have been a part of your daily political process. Right, left, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat. To me, these terms have become almost meaningless. They don't describe the current political spectrum very well, and they don't describe whatever is emerging at all. The worst representation of this construct is this red-blue political map that we all know about, and perceived red-blue orientation for the news networks and other media outlets. So in this show, I'm going to talk about the history of the American political spectrum a little bit. I'm going to talk about the so-called conservative movement a little bit, but really I'm talking about the future. It has a lot to do with how we define ourselves and the people we think, quote, agree with us, whatever us is. It has a lot to do with the changing demographics of the United States. It has a lot to do with the changing shape and structure, in other words, the demographics and the economy of the rest of the world. It seems like a number of historical lines are converging on our time. Maybe not 2016 specifically, but this general time period in the first and second decades of the 21st century. I've often talked about how we are on the verge of great changes in the tools we use, what we make, how we make it, how we do what we do, how we sell it, how we communicate, what we do with the tools we have, how we shape the future world. Because a future world is being built on the shoulders of the old world. And for some, this is a very difficult process. We have to say goodbye to the ideas and constructs of the age we were comfortable with, maybe even nostalgic about, in order to embrace the new, whether it is the clear challenges of the post-Depression World War II world, the world before nuclear weapons, or the post-war growth period when America was ascendant and all-powerful between 1946 and 1960s, or the 1960s through the 1980s when the world was defined by a bipolar struggle between the Soviet Union and communism and the United States, and what we might refer to as capitalism. Two major events realigned the world, significantly changing our economics and our politics. One of them was the fall of the Soviet Union in Russia, Eastern and Central Europe, and parts of the Middle East. And the other was the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. And these are not isolated events, but the results of a long series of decisions, reactions, changes in political leadership, economic growth and contractions, and these things all happening both here in the U.S. and across the world. Remember how surprised we were by these two events. Remember how we experienced these events. Remember how we changed as the result of these events. Remember how they were, quote, predictable only in hindsight. The forces that produced 9/11 or the fall of the Berlin Wall or Tiananmen Square developed below the radar. Only people closest to the development of these events understood them as they happened or could have perhaps predicted something like them would have happened. But the rest of us, not so much. Well, that's what's going on in our political system, I think, in the United States right now. And for what it's worth, it's going on across the world, too, whether you're talking about the British vote to exit the European Union, which was a surprise to many of the so-called experts, or continuing economic and political alignment in Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East with unpredictable results. I don't talk about this election on a day-to-day basis on my show or the podcast because I've come to the conclusion that its outcome may not matter. And I don't know that people want to hear it because what they're used to hearing is cheerleading for one side or the other. Regardless of the outcome of this election, I believe the new president is going to be caught up in a maelstrom of change with unpredictable results. The new president and the new Congress, by the way, might actually be transitional. That is, we may not remember much about them and what they did in 30 or 40 years, and certainly not in 100 years. We have had a number of transitional governments in the United States since the Cold War ended. In other words, legislatures and presidents and so forth. Because they've held office during our formative years, most recently, we view them as being much more important than perhaps they actually are. So let's take a look at the current political spectrum, how it's changing, and ask how it's changing, and then we're going to talk about what comes next, because I can't sit here and cheerlead for either side. I can't tell you whether I believe conclusively that one candidate is better than another candidate. I can't tell you conclusively whether the Republicans or the Democrats have the best ideas, because I don't think they know whether they have the best ideas. I don't think that either party really has figured out how to sort of set a course for the future. You would think if you're a Republican, well, yeah, but what about this and what about that? Or you would think if you're a Democrat, yeah, but what about this or what about that? But both parties really aren't addressing the biggest potential challenges of our time. So we could have a big bust election, which means we're going to elect a president, we're going to elect a Congress, we're going to elect one-third of the Senate, we're going to have those political races in states and local counties and places like that. But I'm not even sure the people we're electing really have a clear idea of the future, where we're headed, and how to handle it. So here we go, on the eve of the biggest bust election in modern history in the U.S. And I think what's needed in terms of discussing this, because this has happened before. This is nothing new in American politics, this sort of drift and us being left with candidates that may not be so great, or political parties that really don't have a handle on what the American people want or where we're going or leading the nation. So this is nothing new. So I'm going to put this stuff in context first, historically, and then in context demographically, and then finally some conclusions about what I think is part of the building blocks for whatever the future orientation politically may be. Coming up, how do you define yourself by a political party or orientation? I'm going to do a brief history of the political spectrum in the United States next. This is the Bob Davis Podcast's radio show. Back in the studio just ahead of segment two of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show, and getting ready to, there's two trips coming up in Mobile Podcast Command. One is AgoraFest, which is September 22nd, and then I'm planning on hopefully heading out west after October 6th or so. And I love Mobile Podcast Command, the Ford 450 Super Duty diesel ambulance that is a Mobile Podcast Command studio. And it came from X-Government Cars. And of course, xgovernmentcars.com is really the only dealer in Minnesota specializing in one-owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars and trucks and SUVs. If you need a car, if you need a loan, if you have a job, you can get approved and get a loan. And they take trades. They pay the highest values every day without all the bull. So we're talking about Yukons, Expeditions, Ford Crown Vics while they last, Ford Police sedans, Ford Police SUVs, Dodge Chargers, the V8 Chevy Impalas, and more. Work trucks, or if you are interested in getting an ex-government truck, they've got them. Don't forget the three-day love-it guarantee exclusively at X-Government Cars. They will help you long after the sale. Here's the deal. Get your butt down to X-Government Cars, now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North, 763-777-8782. That's 763-777-8782. XGovernmentCars.com. XGovernmentCars.com. Okay, here is segment two. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast radio show. For more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. Welcome back. Well, I have little interest in the day-to-day comings and goings of the candidates and the chatter about them, even though I covered the presidential primary season from Iowa, South Carolina, and Florida in the summer of 2015 all the way through to the spring of 2016, I find little to maintain my interest. And I'll go further in suggesting that the 2016 election is really a transitional election, which is going to result in a president and Congress I think that few people will remember in 40 or 50 years. In other words, transitional as opposed to a seminal change in American politics predicated on an administration. Now, I could be wrong, and you know, you never know, but my suspicion is that this is just going to be just a transition in time with pretty much the same issues. No one thinks about the issues and personalities that animated the American political scene from about 1900 to 1932 these days, even if they studied them as part of a political science degree in college. Why? Because after 1932, the political spectrum changed. And the political spectrum in this country has always been defined by the primary issues of the day, and they change. And they change polls, and they change directions. Political parties have come and gone. Congresses have come and gone. Presidents have come and gone. So if you've defined yourself by saying, I'm a conservative, or I'm a liberal, or I'm a Republican, or I'm a Democrat, or I'm right or left or red or blue over the last 10, 20, maybe 30 or 40 years, I think you're in for a rude awakening. First of all, the left-right political orientation of our representative republic probably goes back to the French Revolution, but left and right have meant different things over the years. So in 1791, members of the Legislative Assembly of France were seated along something called liberal and conservative lines based on their attitudes toward the then existing government. But American politics can't really be defined by left-right considerations. Our politics is more generally defined by the issues of the time. Yeah, sure, today, left-right, right, red-blue, but really, that's not the way it's been in our history. In different times, there have been different polls, but it isn't always the same polls. Between 1792 and 1824, two main political parties in the United States emerged. One was the Federalist Party, the other was the Republican Party, or the Democratic Republican Party, or what some called the Jeffersonian Republican Party. Basically, Federalists, headed by Alexander Hamilton and George Washington and John Adams, believed in a strong, central, and united government, close ties to Britain, a centralized banking system, and close links between the government and men of wealth. James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and others founded the Republican Party, which strongly opposed Hamilton's ideas about centralized and strong centralized federal governments. The Federalists foundered when they refused to support the War of 1812 and were unable to mount strong opposition to the candidacy of James Monroe, who was an anti-Federalist, whose presidency has been defined historically as the era of good feeling, since by that time the Federalists had pretty much fallen apart between, 1816 and 1824. After 1828, the Democrat-Republican Party split into the Jacksonian Democrats, which was led by Andrew Jackson, by the way, the ancestor of the modern Democratic Party, although not necessarily advocating for the same things, and the Whig Party, led by Henry Clay. Democrats under Jackson supported the primacy of the presidency over other branches of government, but opposed the Bank of the United States and what we would call infrastructure development to benefit industry at the expense of the taxpayer. The Whigs believed in the primacy of Congress and the politics of modernization and economic protection. So, completely different Democrat issues versus today. The Whig Party started to fall apart as the result of the battle over slavery and the decline of the economic issues that unified the Whigs. From 1854 until the 1890s, the modern Republican Party emerged first as an anti-slavery party, but then it also adopted the economic policies of the Whig Party it succeeded, such as advocacy of national banks, railroads, high tariffs, and so forth. The Civil War and Reconstruction polarized the Republican and Democratic parties as they became broad-based, with newly freed slaves joining the so-called Grand Old Party and white Southerners joining the Democrats. From about 1896 until 1932, the issues that animated both parties again changed significantly. This era was dominated by Republicans who embraced progressivism, trust busting, regulation of railroads, corruption in party politics, women's suffrage, and of course, control of immigration. And then from 1933 until now, Democrats emerged as the primary force in American politics with the New Deal, as Republicans lost support after the Great Depression and so-called American liberalism emerged with ethno-religious coalitions, white Southerners and labor unions, large urban political machines, and populist farm groups. And that's the Democratic Party that we sort of know today. And then again, in the 1970s, the political spectrum changed again as the New Deal coalition was eclipsed by the emergence of the so-called moral majority and Ronald Reagan and a need to be strong on defense as it applied to the Soviet Union. I would suggest that the political political spectrum is in the process of changing again with the emergence of the multipolar post-Soviet world and the attack on 9/11. So in thinking about history, think about where you might have come down in the political spectrum of 1800 or 1830 or 1860, but really, where would you have come down during those periods of time before a new direction sort of emerged from politics? Notice how the political parties changed their alliances slowly, sometimes changing their names or adjusting their names as the issues changed. From united and strong central governments to the fight over the supremacy of the presidency versus Congress, to the Bank of the United States, to slavery and secession, to tariffs and development, to progressive Republicans like Teddy Roosevelt, to trust busting, to the Depression and its reaction, to the women's vote, to World War II, to the 1950s and 60s Cold War, to Ronald Reagan. I think new issues are today emerging that are again forcing a transition or a change in the political orientation, the polarization of our politics. Our modern political parties and current media-infused political orientation maps do not describe this process. Now, this list doesn't do the theory justice, but slow economic growth, income inequality, the big banks, the size, scope, and power of government in the form of the surveillance state, racism, terror, the developing world, international trade agreements, the breakdown of the old Cold War order, control of our borders, and economic growth are just a few of the issues where political parties and the political spectrum are on agreement in some areas and disagreement on others. Both are struggling to define themselves and their constituents in this new world. Given the storm, how long before these traditional voting blocks remain intact? So, after we've had a little history lesson, next we're going to look at how demographics change the political landscape. For more of the Bob Davis Podcast, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcast's radio show. Just ahead of segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. Hope you're enjoying this little history lesson about American politics, because some of the reporting and stuff going on, and I'll get into it more in detail in future podcasts, is just driving me crazy right now. Of course, Labor Day has come and gone, and that means fall is coming up, and you're going to need to have your heating checked, and that's where Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul comes in. You know, it always pays every year to have the heating checked, make sure everything is working right, and for emergency service, Ryan Plumbing is always standing by. 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at ryanplumbing.com. They go metro wide from St. Paul, and that of course means the suburbs too. For four generations, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. And as we head into the cooler months, heading into the climate change we know as winter and fall in Minnesota, don't forget to have the heating check, the water heater check, because sometimes that stuff can go crazy when it gets cold, and then you have an emergency problem, and it always pays to have it checked. And while they're out, ask them about in-floor heating and ask them about high-efficiency heat. If you can do it, high-efficiency heating will save you a lot of money over the next 4 or 5 years. Ryan Plumbing and Heating on University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol, where they've always been. For emergency service and for your heating check for fall, think Ryan Plumbing and Heating. 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 online at ryanplumbing.com. And thanks, guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Okay, here is segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. You're You're hearing the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. To sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter, The Bob Line, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. For more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. As we talk about the history of the political spectrum in the United States, we have to talk also about demographics. So we're going to start with the population of this country, and then we'll talk about its makeup. In 1790, there were only 3.9 million people in the U.S. By 1820, there were 9 million. By 1850, 23 million. In 1890, 62 million. In 1930, there were 123 million people in the U.S. In 1960, 179 million. And according to the last census in 2010, 308 million. Remember, they do them every 10 years. Estimates now place the U.S. population at between 320 and 350 million, depending on who you talk to. Using the last census, almost 224 million Americans are white, 39 million black, and 46 million other races, which include those we might define as Asian. The U.S. Census Bureau's definition says that Hispanic does not define a race, so a person of Latin or Hispanic descent may be of any race. So Hispanic is not a race. Until about 1930, most of the people in this country lived on farms or they lived in small towns, rural towns. Today, most of us live in urban areas. Now, that doesn't mean that we are all city dwellers like living in Manhattan. It means we live in and around major and minor cities like New York or Chicago or Portland or Minneapolis and St. Paul, metropolitan areas. According to the U.S. Census, roughly 15% of our population is foreign-born, which is an interesting number when you consider the concerns politically about immigration. That said, Spanish is by far the number one language of foreign-born Americans, but foreign-born Americans have always been a big percentage of our population. About 60% of the people in this country were born in the state of their residence, which is a number that surprised me, suggesting the importance of state-by-state issues even today in the political spectrum. Most of the state-by-state migration in our country is from the northern tier to the southern tier and from east to west. In the 1800s, most of the people in this country were farmers or farm laborers. Today, the professional class has greatly expanded, and most people work in offices, in services, in crafts, or as operators of machinery. Now, the Census Bureau defines labor slightly differently. Laborers account for 4% of the workforce today, peaking at about 12% in the early 1900s, but they define people who operate machinery as workers by modern definition as operatives. This group peaked in the 1950s and 60s at about 20%. So today, laborers and operators account for about 14% of the population of workers, probably lower since last measured in the late 1900s. This is key. As a sector of employment, agriculture peaked about 1910 and manufacturing peaked in the 1960s. America's workers are engaged in much more diverse occupations and more productive occupations, including professional services, transportation, professionals in education, retail, trade, entertainment, personal services, government finance, and so forth. The median age of people in the U.S. has gone from 16 in 1800 to 37 in 2010. Of course, life expectancy has increased and live births per mother have decreased over the years. But according to the 2010 census, roughly 20% of the population is from 0 to 15 years of age, 14% is 15 to 24, and about 26% are 25 to 34. 26% also are 45 to 54. And 13% are 65 plus. Obviously, the census was taken in 2010, so that has shifted a little bit since then. And despite all the talk about the so-called millennials, the definition of this generation isn't always the same. Millennials are generally defined as people born between 1981 and 2015, and there are roughly 75 million of them, depending on what definition you use, making them equal in size to the baby boomers. Sometimes they'll take Gen X and lump them in with the millennials. However, the millennials were not born in the same time frame as baby boomers, from 1946 to 1960. And to put it in context, the U.S. has had a much younger population from about 1800 to 1920 than it does now. Now, we're told younger people identify with Democrats and older people identify with Republicans, which has generally been true for the last 20 years or so, but it doesn't mean it is always going to be that way. Obviously, millennials have different ideas than their baby boomer parents, but when it comes to borrowing and spending their own money and values related to material consumption, they can be pretty conservative. I list demographics here as a benchmark, a context, so people understand the makeup of the U.S. I do not make judgments about these demographics, and the reason is that if you search political ideas by demographics, there are literally thousands of articles and surveys and polls and conclusions by various sociologists, marketers, and political scientists. Political views are rooted in a complex of education, family of origin, age, sex, income, and other sociographic data, which political scientists, marketers, and social scientists argue about constantly. Generally, younger people either don't vote or they vote to the left of their older counterparts. Generally speaking, African Americans tend to vote Democrat, as do Asians, and to a lesser extent, Hispanics versus whites. But it's also true that sometimes it depends on where people live, what they do, who their neighbors are, and so forth. Demographics give you the lay of the land. They don't tell you the whole story, though. One of the things I learned early on starting to do market research for radio is that statistics are like a bikini. What they reveal is enticing. What they conceal is vital. What do you think is vital that we can't see in polling or in the census? I think a better indicator is to look at the issues motivating the political landscape these days versus those of a few years ago, a generation ago, and at the beginning of the Republic. For that, you have to know and love and read history to understand the underpinnings of these issues and how it eventually played out. For example, most of us know and understand the Civil War. We know that the war was fought over the issue of slavery or to decide the issue of states' rights, or both, depending on how you look at it or the context that you believe is key. But when you read about the people and the politics of the time, the way it played out was hardly predictable. Why did people decide to throw in their lot with the Confederacy? It's much more complicated than a simple, it's a no-brainer, we should have gotten rid of slavery a long time before 1860. Did you know, for example, that most Virginians opposed secession in 1860? I didn't until recently. And the division was so pronounced that, of course, Western Virginians formed their own state, which went with the North, and that became West Virginia. So things aren't always what they seem, and they aren't always so easy to figure out, and it's not always so easy to predict which way people are going to go on an issue. Think of your views on any of these issues, a short and incomplete list. The economy, how to deal with ISIS, immigration, the surveillance state, local issues like light rail or the new stadium or a new highway or bridge, racism, same-sex marriage, the big banks or income inequality, government power, the rise of China, Russia's activity in Ukraine and Crimea and the Middle East, and other complicated foreign policy issues. Think about how these issues have changed in the last 10 the last 20, the last 30, and 40 years. Because when, for example, JFK was president, the primary issue was the potential for nuclear war played out in the Cuban Missile Crisis and the beginnings of our involvement in Southeast Asia, and of course, domestically, the economy and civil rights. Just 20 years later with Reagan, it was winning the Cold War definitively, abortion and moral values, and getting the economy to grow dynamically again, and getting government off your back. Remember, JFK passed the biggest tax cut in U.S. history prior to Reagan. 20 years after that, it was addressing terrorism after the attack on 9/11 and making government work more efficiently. And while these are vast simplifications of complex political and social concerns, it gives you the lay of the land demographically and maybe a little bit politically and gives you some context. I think the political landscape is shifting, and I think it is shifting much faster and more significantly than just something driven by headlines and media chatter and demographics. In the interest of time, I kind of had to run through a lot of material very quickly, but at least you have a context now, a baseline from which to judge issues and the country as a whole. Coming up, some final conclusions about the context of our politics and our disillusionment. Next, to hear all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. For more of this show, visit gcnlive.com. To sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter, The Bob Line, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Back in the studio, just ahead of segment four, the last segment for this week's radio show. And of course, new full podcast coming up next week. And it's interesting because this whole experience really kind of taught me how the radio format can be kind of limiting, because these four segments would have been a much different podcast. But this is what fits into the segments for the radio show, and I don't apologize for it. I think it's actually kind of neat because it ends up being a pretty intense four segments of talk radio. Thanks once again to Ryan Plumbing and Heating for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. Don't forget, heating check, water heater check, and for winter emergency service, Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. They are on University Avenue. They do quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems for four generations. They can get a plumber near you in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the suburbs, residential and business, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis. You can call 612-927-6488 online, ryanplumbing.com. And yeah, ex-government cars, the home of Mobile Podcast Command, which will soon be heading out to parts west, accepting donations for Mobile Podcast Command diesel fuel and Komodo Dragon coffee and beef jerky for the trip out west. I'll tell you more about that going forward. But don't forget, xgovernmentcars.com, Minnesota's only dealer specializing in one owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks, and SUVs. I've had three Crown Vics from them, and now Mobile Podcast Command. They are great. If you need a new car, if you need a new loan for the car and you have a job, you can get approved and they take trades. Remember, xgovernmentcars.com, now open in Forest Lake, Minnesota at 2420 Nevada Avenue North, 763-777-8782, 763-777-8782. Get your butt down there or check them out online, xgovernmentcars.com. All right.
xgovernmentcars.com.
Here is segment four. You're hearing the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Remember, for all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. So, we have an election with candidates polls have shown have very high negatives with likely voters. People consistently refer to our choice this year as the lesser of two evils. So regardless of who you're voting for and why, it isn't an election of positive choices, an election where voters are thinking, this is the best way for us to proceed. What I think we have is an election with voters saying, how do I minimize the potential damage to me? And of course, if you're a local, statewide, or congressional candidate, you are left to fend for yourself. And voters are left trying to figure out whether to support a candidate on issues or party line, whether to vote the man or the party or what. Despite the descriptions of Donald Trump as the new Andrew Jackson, I personally think that this election is probably more like the election of 1848 between Zachary Taylor and Lewis Cass, or 1920 between Warren Harding and James Cox, elections that no one remembers. Can we make the wrong choice? Could the new president, regardless of party, make a terrible mistake with catastrophic consequences? Well, it's possible, but the truth is every president since Truman has had the potential of making a terrible, catastrophic choice, whether Republican or Democrat, that could have meant the destruction of the world, let alone the United States, in an instant. But it hasn't happened. The direction of the country, in fact, depends on a lot of factors besides the president. There are obviously cabinet secretaries, justices, generals, and admirals, state governments, Congress, and local governments. And let's not forget the people and how far we can be pushed or how far we want to push our elected officials and, by extension, our government, whatever the issue. Will there be a crisis after the election of a new president in 2017? Well, you can be sure that there will. There will probably be many crises, from economic to foreign policy to domestic. The question is whether the Democrats and the Republicans are still relevant to their constituencies. That is, whether they are talking about issues that really are the building blocks of our future, whether either party even knows those issues in terms of what is the greatest concern, the greatest challenge, and the greatest opportunity to the future of the country. You know, there's still a great debate over the election of 2000. and how Al Gore might have handled the crisis of the September 11th attacks versus George W. Bush. Somehow the country has survived and will survive, sometimes in spite of or because of who was president. We've talked about how our politics and political parties have evolved. We've talked about demographics and how the U.S. has changed. And we've talked a little bit about the challenges and opportunities of the issues over the years. And there's plenty of blame to go around, you know, how we got where we are, wherever it is that we are, from the politicians and their handlers to the media and to the voters themselves. There's plenty of blame for what ails us, from the current president to previous presidents and various institutions of our society that aren't working very well. Very little talk, though, this year about the future. What do we want to build? How do we expect the future is going to look? What do we want it to look like from ourselves and our children and our grandchildren and the people who descend from us who we will never know? What about the rest of the world? Each year, more and more people are counted as Americans, but more are counted as Chinese and Indian citizens and as citizens of a myriad of other countries throughout the world. Let's just take one of them. Brazil counts almost as many people as the United States, and as these places develop, they are more and more likely to have interests that coincide or conflict with ours in strange and unpredictable ways. If we can forget about personalities and the national political stage for a moment, we can forget about the Matt Lauers and the Megyn Kellys of the world. What are the challenges and opportunities facing this country? You know, I have an incomplete list, but I say, and these aren't all of them, and it isn't detailed, and it isn't comprehensive, but our economy hasn't grown more than 2% per year in 8 years. That's unacceptable to me. Millions of people are underemployed or out of the workforce entirely. Our institutions, from education and local governments to airport security to the medical insurance industry, and our ability to control our borders do not seem to work very well these days. We have significant foreign policy challenges, from how to handle terror groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda to the rise of China and an increasingly difficult and bellicose Russia. And there's a lot of social concern about inequality and racism and social unrest that neither party seems to be able to address and sometimes doesn't even discuss. And yet there are a lot of good things going on too. You know, I've traveled across the country more than once. And generally in my travels, I have found, and I've talked about it, a relatively comfortable people, although some, of course, are more comfortable than others. But by and large, the United States remains a pretty powerful and rich country. We are still the largest producers of agricultural products. We have a huge and burgeoning energy industry. We're extremely productive. We're strong in science and technology and services, and we remain inventive. And as I said, productive. We still have the power to do pretty much anything we want to do. The challenges and opportunities of the future include how what is often called the fourth industrial revolution, and that's artificial intelligence, autonomous machines and software and robotics. How is all that going to change how we work, what we make, how we communicate? That same challenge is facing a lot of other countries too across the world, not just here in the United States. And while companies and banks are getting bigger, so are markets as populations increase in size and economies across the world grow. Do they need bigger banks? Do they need multinational companies to serve their needs? What kind of energy needs, banking and services and consumer goods and food, will we need in the future? And how are we going to make sure that it's provided through our economy? The biggest question in all of this is how much government we need or want, given the potential of technology. I also think, actually, that's probably the biggest challenge, since government is so big and expensive today. How do we provide security, maintain law and order, make sure the economy operates effectively, and reduce, at the same time, the size and cost of government? And then we get into these questions that I think are key that I still don't hear anyone really talking about. What is freedom? What does freedom mean to you? We're supposed to be free, but sometimes I wonder whether Americans really want to be free. Are we willing to be responsible enough not to have to depend on some government service. Maybe we want a government that provides all kinds of services. Maybe some people don't want to start a small business, right? Can we have that and protect the Constitution? And speaking of the U.S. Constitution, there are some who feel, and I hate to tell some people this, but there are some who feel it does not speak to this generation. How do we address their concerns and protect the freedoms the Constitution supposedly guarantees and really protect the Constitution? As citizens, do we know our own history? Do we know the arguments? Do we know what we're about personally before we start criticizing, mocking, and burning and snarking and so forth? Are we willing to do the work necessary to get through a political turning point? It isn't just the politicians and the media and the political parties. We, the people, also have a role in being out of touch or being unable to grapple with issues, regardless of our political affiliation. I personally think it's something new is coming. I've talked about it, and I don't think it's going to be defined by the current political institutions and maybe not even by the current government and societal institutions. How, for example, would you accommodate the arrival of fusion power or artificial intelligence so advanced it could build its own machines, to build whatever we might need, from washing machines to computers and automobiles? What about technologies that will most certainly arrive sooner than we expect, or the potential for disasters because of hacking? Or Zika or Ebola, longer lifespans, the collapse of the financial system, or anything else in the world. I don't see how the current political parties address these issues. Some boil down to bigger issues, more easily given to rhetoric or so-called simple solutions. But what's the overarching philosophy, and does it work with these new wrinkles? Does the modern Republican Party or the modern Democrat Party really address the issues that they say they do? The answer is neither represent the changing needs and wants of the American people today, because things are changing very quickly and gathering speed. We're at a turning point in history. Politics just hasn't caught up. Now, of course, my big disclaimer is that you can't predict the future. The people that have lived through these turning points didn't really define the turning points before they occurred. They couldn't see what was coming. So I guess we can say with pretty strong confidence that something new is coming, but we're probably not going to see it in 2016. So the question is, what are we going to do after 2016 to prepare the political environment for this turning point? Yeah, kind of heavy and detailed, but lots of fun to do. So thanks for listening through all of that. That's going to do it for this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Remember, for all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Pilots, listen up. If you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. What is angle of attack? It's the amount of lift that's holding your airplane in the air and on the final turn to runway. That is a really important thing. And if you have a visual indicator, it's much safer. And of course, Alpha Systems has the best visual indicator in the business. Find out more about it and give yourself some good luck. Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcasts.com. And thanks to you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, BlogTalkRadio.com, and of course, GCNLive.com and The Patriot in Minneapolis and St. Paul for the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Thanks for finding me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command, again, at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 547. I'm going to walk out in the field and have my coffee now.